Hello, my name is Clifford Gaddy. I'm a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. A couple of weeks ago, some colleagues and I had a discussion about the protest movements in Turkey and in Russia. And today I'd like to continue that conversation, though taking it in a somewhat different direction. We want to talk a little bit about the economics of the protest, what similarities there might be across countries, and what specific features we might observe in cases like Russia or Turkey. And I have with me today my colleague, Carol Graham. Carol is a senior fellow in our program for Global Economy and Development. And Carol is a specialist on the economics of happiness, one of the pioneers in that area that's become very, very popular now, and I think particularly applicable to issues of protest that we're observing worldwide right now. So Carol, could I ask you just briefly to summarize what is this notion of the economics of happiness? And if you would, just a little bit about how this might relate to some of the protest movements we're seeing globally right now.
Thanks, Cliff. Sure. The economics of happiness comes from a nascent collaboration many years ago between economists and psychologists, where economists started listening to psychologists and vice versa for the first time, and has now developed into a whole new science for measuring well-being. What makes people happy, what makes them angry, what makes them stressed, and how do the determinants of well-being correlate with behaviors that we care about, how people perform in the labor market, when do they protest or not, how about their health status. And we have very good metrics that can link well-being with behavioral outcomes that we care about. And so one of the things that we've discovered, or sort of basically started this whole science, is that traditional notions that income and well-being ran hand in hand and people with more income were always happier or more content wasn't necessarily the case, and that there were paradoxes. The paradox of unhappy growth is something I've discovered. People in very rapidly growing countries report to be less happy than people of the same income level in less rapidly growing countries because of raised expectations. This is relevant to the protests, of course. Something else I found called the paradox of happy peasants and frustrated achievers. When you look at, again, people in countries that are developing or changing, some of the poorest people report to be content, and people who are moving up the income ladder can report to be very frustrated, even though they've made these tremendous income gains. The same goes with migrants. Migrants from, in urban China, for example, whose income has quintupled from 5 years ago, are all of a sudden very unhappy because of the change. Their reference norm has changed. Their expectations have changed. So back to your original question, the metrics we have, the science that we're developing, allows us to understand a seemingly paradoxical combination of frustration on the one hand and growth in income on the other.
Okay, so these are important concepts, and I'm just going to repeat it, that the idea that between objective measurements of wealth or income and behavior or attitudes, there is this link of, quote, well-being, which is a sense of how well off people think they are, as opposed to how some objective measure of their per capita income or their monthly income might suggest. Now, let me ask you also just to say briefly, say a word about the fact that you have at least done work on Russia. I know you have, since we've done work together and written articles together, but that was several years ago. But I think that the data sources that you're working with are very important in trying to understand what one could say with some degree of reliability about a case like Russia as well as other countries.
Right. Well, we initially started, when you and I worked together on Russia, we had a Russian, a very extensive and very good, high-quality Russian survey. Since then, I've been benchmarking those results against what we now have, the Gallup World Poll, which is a worldwide survey of over 130 countries in the world, an annual survey from 2006 on. So we can compare with the same questions, the same measures of income, the same measures of education and everything else, not just income and well-being across countries, but different dimensions of well-being. And we have very fine-grained metrics now. So we can measure well-being in terms of people's life evaluations, their ability to live their life as they want. But we can also measure anger, stress, and just daily experience. Did people enjoy their day yesterday or not? And one of the things that we find is that there are big differences across these measures. So sometimes very poor people with low expectations do fine on enjoying their day yesterday, low anger, low stress. And it's this group that we're interested in, this protesting group, which has regularities across many countries, where people are making gains, they're making changes, they are trying to become middle class if they're not middle class. And yet if you look at their daily metrics, the way their day is, they're stressed, they're often angry, they're vulnerable, all these things play out in these metrics. And we can compare Russia roughly with a lot of other countries that have had similar phenomenon. Brazil and Turkey are the two that most come to mind at this mm-hmm. point.
And what do you see, at least in terms of the reading you have, or even the data you might have, do you see similarities and differences in those three cases in particular, Brazil, Turkey, and Russia?
I'll focus on the similarities because I think the differences are at some level relevant to each country and also more refined. But basically you have an age cohort, which is roughly middle-aged, 25 to, or young and middle-aged, about 25 to 45. When people are establishing themselves within a system, they're coming to grips with the system that they are trying to strive in, and they may or may not like that system. They find out that as they go. They're not the poorest. They're usually lower middle income. They're usually rising in their levels of income. So they're sort of trying to enter the ranks of the middle class, if you can think of that concept roughly defined. They're usually well educated, usually college educated, or at least some college education. They have, in a way, the typical profile of some of the old sociological articles about what makes people middle class, right? Mm-hmm. They're not poor, they're educated, they have a professional status or the ability to attain professional status, to be part of the system in the way that the old articles on the middle class used to say the middle class is so mm-hmm. important because people have a stake in the system. But what is happening to these cohorts, as far as I can tell, and there's similarities across Turkey, Brazil, and Russia, is that while they're doing okay economically, they're making economic gains, they have genuine frustrations with the system that they're trying to operate in. And just quickly, in Brazil, the frustrations are mainly about things like health insurance, quality of democracy, quality of public goods, all the things that would make their lives better in addition to income, and that would make their lives less vulnerable. And vulnerability is a thread that will run through this. In Turkey, I think you have some similar kinds of strains running through. You also have in Turkey the divide between sort of a more traditional Islamic view of how society should be and the more secular view that a lot of the protesters were certainly pushing for and seem to be driving some of that sentiment. In Russia, I think what you have, and you should speak more to this than I should, I think you have a sort of, again, groups that are what we would call, and you and I have worked together on entering the creative class. These are people who are well beyond poverty. They're becoming part of the world economy. So their aspirations actually mirror those in the rest of the world. They have access to social media. They're very informed. And yet that clashes with some of what, at least I understand, is the way the Russian economy works, and certainly the way the Russian polity works. So I hope maybe you can build on that a little bit.
Well, what you said is would be very fertile ground for any Russia political specialist and other sociologist who would try to understand these protest movements. So I'm sure they're going to try to read what you've written and try to take it from there. But let me just give you a couple of stylized facts about the Russian case. You described part of it. There's clearly, I mean, I think that it's a great description of the protesters as a social group is to call them the creative class. Some people call it the new middle class. That's an important distinction because there is something that in economic terms is a very, very large middle class in Russia. A lot of people, because they're highly educated, because they have jobs, relatively stable jobs, either it could be in the industrial sector or the government sector, or science, technology, and yet they're different from this creative class. They don't really fit the profile of the kind of people that you were describing as potential for protest. One thing is they don't live in Moscow, or at least those who are protesting are predominantly concentrated in Moscow, and to some extent in other large cities, but really in Moscow. This other old middle class, if you like, this is more like the Soviet intelligentsia and the skilled workers of the Soviet era. And in fact, they still work in these Soviet-type facilities, institutions, and plants. And Vladimir Putin has clearly decided that's where he's going to stake his fortunes. He's going to base, that's his constituency. These are his people. He's going to do everything for them to keep them from being frustrated. And so in one sense, I can see that frustration obviously is the threat for any leader, whether it's frustrated achievers, those who are have high aspirations for moving up. That's one group in Russia. The other would be frustrated if their stable, predictable, steady incomes and jobs and so forth were to be threatened. And do you, when you look at a situation like that, can you see that both of these groups can fit into the kind of research that you've done and the conclusions you have?
Absolutely. I think your old middle class would be basically loss averse. They have a stake in the system. They don't want it shaken up. And because they have some level of security, that's going to matter a lot to their well-being. The other group at some level wants to change things. They have higher aspirations. They probably want things to operate differently, whether it's the nature of governance or whether it's how dynamic the economy is, opportunities. And both those things could lead to frustration. My sense is from looking at other situations like this that loss aversion actually creates much more stress, much more likelihood of anger than raised expectations and frustrated expectations. I mean, again, that's a guess, but you may disagree with me.
No, I don't disagree, but I think that's incredibly interesting. You know, ever since you started this work on happiness, I've been saying that your biggest client is probably going to be autocratic regimes that need to manipulate their populations.
You have been saying that.
And I've always told you, whenever the Putin regime contacts you for advice, let me know. So, but seriously, if that is true, what you just said, that the risk-averse part of the population is more, if you like, a more explosive, potentially explosive part, then in a way, Putin has made the right choice. Because he has, in fact. He's written off this creative class protesters. He'll suppress them selectively the way he's done with their leaders, but he really pays a lot of attention to these kinds of people that fit into the old middle class.
Can I just add one thing to that? There are just two things that would support that interpretation. One is that just the whole behavioral economics literature shows that people value losses disproportionately to gains, right? So losing something that you have is far worse for your psychological well-being than not gaining something. And the benefits of gains tend to be ephemeral. And there's sort of the income and non-income dimension. And in terms of security, I think there's a lot that comes with this professional status, some sort of insurance that the old middle class has that are things that people really don't want to give up. And they wouldn't trade more income to lose those things. The creative class probably doesn't really have those things. And the creative class probably has more alternative ways of making it. Mm-hmm. They aren't stuck in or vested in a particular system with a particular kind of insurance, a particular kind of existence. They are, by definition, they're hooked into the world economy. Things are changing much more quickly. They have more means to make changes. And, you know, my guess is that their protests, while important and should be listened to, are likely to be more ephemeral than if you were to take away the stability that this other older middle class has.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. Before we run out of time, Carol, I just wanted to quickly ask you, when you think about your own future research or sort of cutting edge aspects of this happiness research that you're doing, is there anything you'd like to mention, especially things that might have relevance for these countries like Russia, Turkey, Brazil?
Right. Well, actually, there's something that I think that's very relevant to these countries and also to the particular dichotomy we're talking about right now, our latest research is really looking at people's capabilities and agency, their ability to control their own lives, and how that links to different dimensions of well-being. And so we find as people acquire agency, we have a new paper on technology access. As people acquire access to technology, it makes it well-being in terms of life evaluation, their capabilities improves, but they also get more stress and anger because their lives become more complicated and they learn more about how the rest of the world lives. We're doing a lot of work to try and understand this whole process of going from whether it's depending on a system that's very secure but doesn't have many opportunities as the old Soviet system has, or whether it's going from a very simple, poor daily existence life in poverty to a more complicated lower middle class life where one's work might be in a city and it entails much more complications. We find a real stress effect. So people's lives may be better in some dimensions, but they're more complicated and often more difficult in others. And this is exactly a group that's ripe for protest. So the back to the point about the old middle class and the new middle class, I think the way this might play out and why I said I would worry more about the old middle class is that this new creative class has more capabilities and agency. They're more used to being self-reliant. They're more used to saying, you know, if this avenue doesn't work, I can get on social media and check out something else. And so I think that whole area of how the interplay between people's ability to control their own lives, to whether it's to become professionals or to do whatever they want to do with their life, how that intersects with the system that they live in and whether the system holds them back or not, mm-hmm. is also quite relevant to the protests across the board. And back to Brazil and Turkey, in addition to Russia, I think in Brazil, it's the sense that the public system doesn't provide the sorts of services that support moving to the next stage, good health insurance and other good public education. And in Turkey, as far as I can tell, I think it's this clash between secularism and sort of the way the sense of cosmopolitanism and a more traditional religious kind of life that these people who are taking control of their own lives, acquiring agency and capacity, are very frustrated with.
Well, thank you, Carol. This has been a very enlightening conversation. I know, at least in my mind, and I'm sure in many other people who are listening to you, it's going to raise a lot of questions. So we'll look forward to further research on your part, new books, new articles.
Thanks a lot. Thank you, Cliff. I hope to hear more about Russia from you.